Well, let me introduce myself. So my name is Richard Campbell. That's my Twitter handle, which is sort of taken over for blogging and everything else. I would say easily the easiest way to reach me, as I'm for better or worse, on Twitter quite a bit, and it's easy to get me that way. But I'm happy to talk to folks. I talk all the time. If you've never run across me before, I am older than I look. My mother says when I turned 15, I hit about 35, and I've been there ever since. So for a long time, I always looked older than my age, and now I look substantially younger than my age. So in 1977, the computer of choice was a TRS-80 Model 1. It had 4K of RAM, a cassette tape player, 127x47 resolution for the graphics, and 3 error messages: what, how, and sorry, which I still think are some of the best error messages ever. In fact, most of the time when you see an ASP.NET error message, you know, with the gold bars and all that, I just think, sorry. Or, object not found. Sorry. The only difference now is we've got Windows, so it's bad enough that my computer's telling me I have an error, but it makes me agree with it, too. Okay. Registry is corrupt. Okay. No, not okay button. I come from, you start that far back, you build your own gear. I learned networking from the beginning. You know, I did ArcNet, I did Thick Ether, I did Token Ring, because everybody needs a plug the size of your hand. And then you end up in software, because computers are kind of boring if you don't write any software. So I ended up in scaling and performance, because when you actually have a good head for how the hardware works, how the networking works, how the software works, that's where those problems lie. You know, in the end, you're trying to make things go faster, and you have to find the bottleneck and stretch it out. And there'll be another bottleneck somewhere else, and you got to stretch that one out. And it's the, you know, they talk about when you're scaling really big websites, it's like painting the Golden Gate Bridge. When you get all the way to the end, it's time to start again. And you just keep going over and over again. And so I also found that people tended to pay more for that, and I only want to work so much, so I do the work that pays the best, so I ended up in scaling work. But I haven't just scaled websites. I've scaled stuff like DCOM. And if you ever scaled DCOM, you know the D actually stands for dumb. And I've described myself as harnessing my ADD for the forces of good. I like working on lots of different things, and so the current work varies quite a bit. Strange Loop Networks is a company that was originally a research project back in 2004. It was an idea that me and a group of my friends that were really into making websites go faster could build an appliance, a piece of hardware that you could put into the network that would make the website go faster. And it took us about 2 years to prove we were right. We filed patents in 2006. We've been working on it ever since. It's a fun gizmo. Building hardware, by the way, hard. Software's great, right? But, you know, if you've got a bug in a piece of software, you can just fix it and run it again. If you've got a bug in a piece of hardware, you have a big pile of boxes you don't need anymore. I still get out in the field. For those who think I podcast all the time, I still get out in the field on a routine basis. In fact, I'll be doing it next week as a consulting architect. So I sit down with companies. Typically, we're talking about high-performance systems because that is my personal passion, but I review designs on a regular basis. It's fun to do real work and to really help folks build software. I don't, sometimes they're my projects, sometimes somebody else's. It feels all the same to me. I've had to make a separate slide for the podcast because it's gotten out of control. So in 2002, my friend Carl Franklin decided to make an MP3 file. And really, he got the idea from the speaker's lounge at conferences like TechEd. Like, we should put a camera in the speaker's lounge. You're supposed to work in the speaker's lounge. Right? You're supposed to be working on your session. But the reality is everybody's chatting with everybody else. And it's really something to see, a guy like Rocky Locke and a guy like Billy Hollis argue about user interface design. Like, two of the best minds I know of. And Carl was smart enough to say, more people should hear that conversation, so I'm going to record it. And he published it up as an MP3 file. He didn't call it a podcast back then because the word hadn't been invented yet. So he was really the pioneer here. Notice we're coming up on the 10-year anniversary of the first .NET Rocks, which I find disturbing. I was a guest on show number 69, and you can take from that what you will. And then, but we sort of became inseparable after that. We enjoyed each other's company. I think about this stuff all the time anyway. And so by show 100, he asked me to be his co-host. Now, that was a pretty good deal for me because The first 50 shows was done with a guy named Mark Dunn, really nice gentleman from Atlanta, what I really think of as a Southern gentleman, and a wonderful guy. And after 50 shows, you know, Mark had said, okay, I've made my point, I've done my time, I'm going to move on. And so that's when Rory Blythe came along, and Rory Blythe was a whole other cat. It's hard to describe Rory Blythe, actually. I would suggest if you want to have an insight into Rory Blythe, you listen to shows 51 to 100. They're not our most sophisticated shows ever, but they are interesting and certainly get insight into him. So Rory did 50 shows, and then he retired, and I got invited. I thought, good deal, I'll do 50 shows. 500 shows later, I'm like, okay, I'm not learning. But we're still going. Now I'm sort of thinking maybe I'll go to 1,000. So we're almost at 800 now. It's twice a week we publish, Tuesdays and Thursdays. We get a .NET luminary on the, well, generally the Tuesday show is the tech show. I focus, you know, sort of serious technology on Tuesdays. So that'll be a guy talking whatever we care about in the .NET space. Maybe it's ASP.NET, maybe it's F sharp, maybe it's C sharp. We talk a lot about parallelism lately because I think it's going to be very important. And then the Thursday show, we get a little, we'll try stuff. Talk about careers, talk about a little bit of history, and then there's these geek outs. So the geek outs are once a month on a Thursday. We geek out about something we think is cool. So we've done shows on electric cars. We've done a number of shows on space. We've done shows on alternative energy. And we take suggestions from the listeners. If you want us to do something, we'll do it. I have a list of show ideas. I'd like to do a show on plasma aerodynamics because I think that's cool. But, you know, they're geek out shows. Run As Radio is a far more serious show. It's an IT pro show because I really am trying to exercise both half of my mind. And while there's a lot to do in dev, there's a lot to do in IT. So once a week, we're over 250 now, and we focus on IT pro topics. I'm the only piece of software Microsoft makes that I'm truly afraid of is Exchange. So we talk about Exchange. I can handle SQL. You should be afraid, right? I continue to run my own Exchange server because I need to be scared on a regular basis. And keep, you know, pointing a gun at your email all the time, pretty compelling way to keep yourself scared. The tablet show we started in the fall of last year. I think we're at 35 or 36 episodes once a week because we just realized that tablets and mobile as a topic need to be done every week. So every week we're talking, it's not just about Win8, it's not just about FinPhone. We do some iOS and some Android. We're looking at some of the cross-development techniques, so some phone gap episodes. They've been really a lot of fun. Tough shows to do because we're right at the edge of our understanding. I'm really thinking about how workspaces are going to change as certain classes of work move away from the keyboard and the mouse. I think it's a big deal. And so, you know, you're going to see that manifest in the tablet show. All right, but let's get to the topic at hand. This talk is one I have continued to revise over the years because it's something that I deal with on a routine basis. Making websites scale up is an interesting challenge, and there's a logical progression when you do this a few times. You start to see patterns on how apps evolve. So from a 50,000-foot view, I want to walk you through a story of how a website evolves, and I'm hoping that you'll see your site somewhere in that path, and then we could talk about what that site looks like the next largest scale and the next largest scale. And this is relatively technologically agnostic. I mean, I'll certainly talk about it in the context of ASP.NET, but it doesn't have to be. An awful lot about the way you think about these things, it doesn't matter what the technology is. There's always a session store. There's always a load balancing strategy. There's always a rendering cost. I mean, all of those things exist there. And I've scaled ASP.NET a long way. You're perfectly capable. Some of the biggest sites in the world have run on ASP.NET. The technology is imminently capable. The challenge is that ASP.NET is really good at building websites fast. Not necessarily building fast websites. The two different techniques are opposing. Okay? So the tech, you know, you understand, if you hire me to come in and work with you on a performance problem with your website, you already have a good problem. People are using your website. You know, if you've got a website that nobody's on, it's probably really fast. Right? So I usually, you know, open the conversation of, well, congratulations, you have a good problem. You have a website busy enough that people care how fast it is. You know, that's a good place to be. The odds are that you built it as quickly as possible, got as many features built as soon as you could, use those fast techniques, and now you're paying the price that those techniques are not necessarily performant. And we have to revise those features, for better or worse, right? But first, you know, if you build at the highest performance techniques right off the bat, they tend to be much slower to build features. It takes longer. And maybe nobody will ever care about your website. So I think you made the right choices. You know, build the features as quickly as you can. Take those shortcuts initially. Get traction. Then we can talk about performance. All right. A couple of measurements I want to talk about. Numbers. How do we assess how popular, how busy our websites are? Different people measure them different ways. So we often, the marketing folks and management typically talk about capacity. Number of known users. It's a favorite number that Facebook uses. I don't think it's a particularly valuable number. You know, you can create an awful lot of accounts. Whether they do anything is another question entirely, right? Known users is a trivial. Active users is more interesting. And again, we're thinking in the context of ASP.NET, how many sessions are alive right now? Default setting is 20 minutes. So for to have the set of active sessions means that cookie has hit the website in the past 20 minutes. Now, that's a little more interesting a number, because it does show some sense of activity. The more powerful number and capacity is concurrent users. How many users are literally having a web page rendered for them right now? And you would be amazed just how many users you can serve with a concurrency of one. You know, if you're rendering pages in a fraction of a second and they're only hitting at one a second, which is actually a lot of users, you still have a concurrency of one. You'd also be amazed how many websites get into trouble as concurrency rises to two. Because the rules start to change. But that's capacity numbers, and they don't tell us an awful lot about the site. IT folks tend to think about throughput, which is, it makes sense, because this is really talking about what a given site can serve. The page views per month is often the only known number, right? Marketing generally knows page views per month. And, you know, we get 10 million page views per month. And I could probably guess what your peak load is if you're pushing down that many page views, but it depends on the site. You know, these are all relative numbers. But when you get down to transactions per second and requests per second, I put both there because I look at requests per second as what the human does and transactions per second as what happens. So you can look at transactions per second from a database point of view, but you can also look at it from a page rendering point of view. The user makes a request for a web page, but you know perfectly well that web page has many other pieces to it. And those are all parts of those transactions. So the transaction per second tends to be the bigger number. And then performance. This is where the software developer lives, right? And if they're optimists, they measure load time in milliseconds. The pessimists, maybe seconds. And then you get this whole idea of time to first byte, time to last byte, which I don't get too hung up on, but it, you know, these are measurements. And it really works, helps to have a graph like this. And I know we're doing review here. We should all know this, but it's easy to forget. Even this graph lies to us. So we go through this sequence of the browser starts up, a page is requested, the HTTP GET flies over the internet, hits that web server, and it starts to render the page. So the beginnings of a computation. Maybe it needs a cookie, maybe it has to grab some session, it does some database access, there's a bunch of stuff that goes on in there, and it begins to push back a response. As that response flies back across the internet, hits the browser, time to first byte. Okay? Now, the page begins to render, and there are JS requests and CSS requests and images being requested. And so that's why this graph lies to us, because I've given an equal amount of time to the initial page request as I am to everything else that goes into that page. All of those additional round trips back to complete the page before we render complete time to last byte. Although time to last byte and render complete, not necessarily the same, nor the same on different browsers, because it would be too easy if they were all the same. Okay, so let me change your thinking a little with this performance equation. Anybody seen this before? Hands up, have you ever seen the performance equation before? I have talked about it before. It's relatively unknown. I did not invent this. It's actually derived from some work of a guy named Peter Sevick, who's wicked smart, who was really trying to solve WAN performance problems. That's what he was looking at. And so we tinkered with it a little bit to make it a web performance equation. So what we're trying to do here is break out the pieces of the load that go into a response time. Because we usually have R, right? We know the response time of a page. Now we're just trying to figure out what it goes into that. So there's four bits to this equation, more or less. On the left side, the payload over bandwidth. So give me the total number of bytes you're bringing down. That's the page, the images, the JS, CS, all that stuff, divided by the total amount of bandwidth. That's going to be a part of the response time. And usually not that much. I mean, we often stop there. You know, if you are all about white space reduction, reducing the size of page, you're trying to do payload reduction. In fact, one of the things we do at Strange Loop, we write this equation at the top of a board, and every time we're tinkering with performance, trying to improve things, we look at how are we influencing this. If we're reducing payload, we're working on that piece. The next piece over was the latency piece, this round trip time. Don't worry about moving the bytes. How long does it take to go from your browser to the server and back again? Because there's latency in there. And it's one of the places as software developers, as website builders, that we lie to ourselves. Because our labs don't have much latency. There's not a lot of latency in this wire, right? If we're working inside of a lab, we've probably got 5-6 millisecond ping times, right? Really, really fast. But as soon as you throw that website onto the internet, even if it was here in Orlando, we'd have 25 or 30 milliseconds of latency. If it was in LA, we'd be 70, 80, 90, depending on how good the backbone was feeling that day. If we're across the pond, right, go across to the UK or maybe to Japan, it's going to be 150. If you're on the other side of the world, you can easily get to 250. And that's, again, if the internet's not grumpy that day, because sometimes the internet is grumpy. If you're one of those sorry folks that is trapped with a satellite uplink, so I've done a lot of work in developing nations where we don't have landlines, and so we use Hughes DSS or Thuraya or any one of these satellite uplinks, they're going off of geostationary satellites, which are 22,600 miles up. And the speed of light is one of those numbers that's tough to beat. It's 300 milliseconds each way. And so we were putting together a rig like this to do data transfers, and supposedly the Hughes DSS is 500 megabit connection. I mean, it should be honking fast, but we're transferring files, and it's sending 1K and then checking the CRC. 1K, check the CRC. So 1K, 600 milliseconds, check the CRC, 600 milliseconds. We're getting 1K transfer rates. Oh, boy. Change the packet size to 100K. Now we're bounding 100K up there, get the CRC back, and we're getting 100K a second. Latency matters. Now, we break out latency here into one round trip, which is the page request, and then app turns, which are all the resource files, multiplied by the round trip time, divided by the number of concurrent requests. Now, how many concurrent requests do we get? Depends on the browser. If you're going to follow the HTTP 1.1 specification, right, which is an R, you're going to be allowed 2. Oh, boy, right? IE7, 2. It follows the rules, unless you're downloading a JavaScript file, in which case it's 1, because the downloader and the parser are intertwined, and so as soon as it has a JavaScript file in line, it'll stop the other connection while it parses all the JavaScript. Fine feature. As of IE8, they just broke the rules, went to 4. Chrome goes to 6. I think IE10 is going to go to 8. So they're just opening up more simultaneous connections. And it's one of the ways we can actually tweak performance is to play with concurrent requests. So that's our latency piece, and it's a chunk of the time. Two more numbers, compute time on the client, compute time on the server. So this compute time on the client is how long does it take the client to render the page. Compute time on the server is, you know, your fault. You know, what's your code done? Or your DBA's fault. It's usually the DBA's fault. Now, how do we get these numbers? And by the way, you know, all these slide decks, and this is my TechEd 101 hat going back on, are on the my TechEd site, right? So you can have this deck, because in my deck, I have embedded a spreadsheet using this equation. Here's the decomposition of these numbers. So I know what my response time is. It's 4.5 seconds. And you notice I've used the approximation symbol there, that wavy equals, because I haven't got everything in this equation. I haven't worried about TCP/IP negotiation. I haven't worried about DNS lookups. I've skipped a few things, because they usually don't amount to much. So just to keep the equation from being totally insane, we've left those pieces out. So how did I get the numbers? First thing I did was I went to websiteoptimization.com. The link's down at the bottom there. The site's still there. Free service. You can type in any URL, and it'll read the page in as if it was a browser. In fact, you can specify what browser it's going to read it in as. And then it'll come back with a bunch of useful numbers. So I went to the .NET Nuke site, and actually a while ago, and pulled in the page. And it gave me a breakdown of the HTML, the number of images, the amount of bytes of CSS, all of those things. So my total payload, 208K. It also got me the total number of requests, 51. Then I figured out my bandwidth. So I ran speedtest.net, run whatever one you want. I like speedtest, the gauges are cute, right? Whatever makes you happy. And you can see my cable modem had a good day that day. I got 7,000 kilobits per second down. Kilobits, not kilobytes. So if we really want to look at that number, we ought to divide it by 8, right? Although I think you really should divide it by 10 because there's a stop and start bit as well. So 700K per second download. We don't need to worry about upload. Round trip time, I used ping. And I pinged out, it was 85 milliseconds, there and back. Now, if you're a network guy, you're cringing right now, right? Because ping is ICMP, which is a totally different protocol from web, which is TCP on port 80. And if you're worried about that, there is a tool mysteriously named TCP ping that you can download, and it will ping on port 80 and give you the ping time. And you'll find that generally they're the same, okay? But if you want to check, it's worth checking. I have had circumstances where it mattered. I had a client who had built a site and done all the testing in-house, and they deployed it, and certain pages wouldn't work. Big pages. The only thing I noticed about the pages didn't work was they were over a meg, which is big page. And they wouldn't work, meaning they would partially render and they'd just sort of stop halfway through their rendering, which clearly means it's the developer's fault. So the developer would run on his machine, it would work perfectly, so they could not reproduce and walk away. And so we started trying to do some testing. What's going on? It obviously works inside, but it doesn't work outside. So I'm using apps like Website Optimize and other remote access to ping in and say, yeah, you're right, I can reproduce this. Certain pages, certain formats, clearly this page doesn't work. Why doesn't it work? And so I started working my way through the performance equation, testing different elements of this, and one of the things I did was TCP ping, because regular ping showed a pretty normal ping time, but when I did TCP ping, it was like 5 times more. That was my first hint, and I have summarized a week of ripping my hair out in about 30 seconds, but when I did TCP ping and realized there was something about TCP port 80 that was a big deal. So my response was I made a temporary version of the website on port 8080 and tried it again, and everything worked. Port 80 matters. It was the PIX firewall. PIX firewall was statefully inspecting every single page, inbound or outbound. It turns out it's got about a 1 meg buffer. We were overflowing the buffer and killing the page, and it was generating nice log error messages every time that happened. If you look at them, you can usually figure stuff out. Two more numbers, server code timing, client code timing. No way around this, you just have to write the code for this. Okay, although there's more libraries out there these days, like Cucumber, that'll make this a little easier to do. So server code timing, grab a timestamp at the top of the beginning of the page in ASP.NET, at the response complete or at the end of the page, the difference, you grab another timestamp, the difference is how long that took. Client's about the same, right? In the header, grab a timestamp. In the page on load event, which depending on the browser is more or less when the page is finished loading. And I say more or less because every time I try a different browser, it's slightly different. And the difference between those is how much time it's spent on the client. Now, what you do with those numbers is, you know, the next problem. Okay, I've got these numbers now. What do I do with them? I have created a fake image as a dynamically generated link in the page that included in the query string those numbers so that it appeared in the web server log files with the right cookie. It's a good way to actually, you know, then we wrote a tool to parse all that out so we get those timings. I've built an iframe so that when you add percent debug equals true, the numbers just appear on the page, which we started shipping with, because then when you had a production complaint, you just add that to the query string and get the real results back from anybody. Find out, yeah, this guy's running Netscape 2.1 on a 286, and he's complaining about client performance, oddly enough. Now, we've got all these numbers. Here's that spreadsheet I was talking about, embedded in the page. So I've taken those numbers, plugged them into the spreadsheet. So a 208K payload at 700K per second, so of the 4.5 seconds, 0.3 of it is payload over bandwidth. Reducing white space, probably not going to do a lot for us. 51 app turns at 85 milliseconds of 2 concurrent requests, 2.1 seconds. And then 0.8 on the server, 1.2 on the client. Right. And we got to about 4.45 on a 4.5 measure. We'll write the rest off to TCP/IP negotiation and DNS. So you're a web developer. And your boss comes to you and says, this page is too slow. You need to fix it. My first thought is, he needs a hobby. Maybe fishing? I don't know. 4.5 seconds is pretty good, right? No, he's read the Forrester report. Every page has to be 2 seconds or less, so you got to get 2 seconds out of this page. Now, what are you going to do? You're a web developer, and you haven't been to my session. So you're going to sit down in front of your machine, probably on a Saturday, because you don't want to be interrupted, and you're going to pull up the code for that page, and you're going to stare at it until blood comes out of your forehead, right? But just imagine you knock it out of the park. You have a genius moment. You rewrite the code of the page, and you double the speed of the rendering. You went from 0.8 to 0.4. And your boss is just not that impressed. You follow me? The issue here is working on the right problem. And you can see, what's the number we should go after? Well, there's 2 seconds of latency. You're not going to get rid of all the latency, but what if we combined all the JavaScript files into one file, right? Just use Script Manager for that. CSS, same thing. I could probably get 20 files out of there, maybe a little browser caching. Haul a second or two off this page, calm that guy down. You might still have a weekend. The thing the equation helps us do is just break out the problem, right? Make sure we're working on the right things. Decompose the issue. Because in the end, you are going to have a scaling problem eventually. This is a scaling talk. And so far, I've only talked about performance, right? This is single-user performance numbers we've done so far. And what parts of this equation don't scale? Well, certain numbers are not going to change no matter how many users we've got. Payload, app turns, concurrent requests, even round-trip time. Some variability, but that's not going to be affected by the number of users. Bandwidth. Well, last time I looked, the internet scaled pretty well. You just buy more. In fact, the only number that doesn't scale here long-term is compute time on the server. So your basic instinct wasn't bad. But don't jump there. Don't start there. In fact, I use the performance equation to prove we're having a scaling problem. If we're actually having a scaling problem, the only number that's going to move as the number of users goes up is compute time on the server. The rest of the numbers should remain pretty steady. In fact, when I'm going after a really high-scaling site, I look at the performance of a single user, right? I set that as a line. And I want the performance of 10,000 users to be at the same line. In fact, my job is to move that gap. And I'm willing to move both lines. I'm willing to sacrifice a little single-user performance to get us closer to our multi-user performance. Move both lines together. Whether that's 1,000 users, 10,000 users, 100,000 users, let's figure it out. Okay? Trying to get the lines together. Compute time on this client rarely is a critical issue, but I like leaving it in the equation because it shows us where time goes, right? As we start having problems in performance and we're struggling with server performance, we can offload time. Ajax, clever technology, proves the perceived performance of the page, but actually increases overall the workload on the server and the client. You'll see it in the equation if you run it. It's worth looking at. It's just knowing where the time goes. All right, so I've started, is this useful? Do you like this? The way of thinking about the problem, okay? So I want to set this as a context, because now I'm going to tell the story. Now let's work through the iterations of the site and talk about the problems that we have along the way. So we're going to need a scenario. So I'm a consultant working for a company, building apps. And we fill out timesheets, right? Normal thing to do. Every day you do a certain amount of work. We're supposed to fill them every day, but we don't, right? Clearly, the timesheets have been put together by accountants, so they're in Excel. And there's lots of codes you have to look up to fill in, and it's a pain, and so we wait till the end of the month, we fill them all, and we hate putting them in. But I am a software developer, I'm a web developer, and I am then inherently lazy. So I build an app, right? This is sort of that viral start of an application. I build the greatest data grid known to man. I basically recorrect the effect of Excel, but I've got lookups for all the codes. I make it much simpler for me to fill in my timesheet. It's always running in the background so I can flip through it and add things to it. And I show it to my boss, and he's wowed because I'm the first person in the history of the company to actually get my timesheet in on time. And so he tells me, roll it out to the whole team, right? 8 guys, we're all going to use this timesheet. And so the first time it runs, and since it wasn't a planned project, I've got it on, you know, like the build server. It's got a IIS running on it close enough, right? It's nearby. And so the end of the month, everybody tries to enter their timesheets at once. They use my app, which they don't understand. As soon as the number of users rose above 1, we had problems. I had to build new reports. You know, we get to 10, 15 requests, 20 requests per second as they're clicking away on things. None of this is actually a scaling problem, right? At this point, this iteration, we're just looking at people bashing around our software and think, you know, our world's greatest data grid makes no sense to anybody else. So you learn how they're using it, you fix it, you build the new things, and just by watching people go on, right? Logical problems, multi-user data, not a performance problem yet. But we get through the first month. It's good. My boss tells a couple of his peers about how great this app is. And how, you know, his whole team has got their timesheets in on time, and everybody likes it, they're correct, they're detailed, and so now he wants their teams to use it. So now we've got 3 more teams involved, right? This is our second version. Now, if we were smart, this probably be a good time to take a step back and say, does the world actually need another timesheet app? Because I bet this problem's been solved before. We might look at software as a service, right? There's any number of directions we could go here, but oh no, we're going to, because our needs are unique, we're going to reinvent the timesheet app once again. And so now I have to add some more features, there's a more diverse user base, and the next month end comes along. Now, first problem we run into is now we're up to 50, 60 people, they're all hammering away at it, so loads are much higher, and there's a couple of guys that are working remote, so they're trying to go in through the VPN to get access to it, and they can't find any access to it because, hey, look, it's on a build server. So then they complain to their boss, who calls my boss, who tells me you better fix it. So I call IT and say, hey, I need a hole punched through the firewall to the build server. And the guy says, you want what? So then he won't do that. I tell my boss I can't do it. He complains to the head of IT. Now, that guy's not sending me a Christmas card next year. And somewhere around there, somebody does a build. Because it is a build server, after all, right? And I set all this up because sooner or later in every app's life, especially one that's sort of grown virally like this, you hit the wall on a server. And most people just don't know what it looks like for a web server to hit a wall. You know, if it did this, at least we know I need a new server, right? And it's not like, maybe it doesn't explode, right? Maybe a little sign popped out and said, help me. And I also know staring at the hard drive light doesn't help, right? It'll blink. It doesn't mean much. Actually, when folks ask me, you know, what, one of the fun things about working at Strange Loop is our lab, like, we literally have a sign that says, we kill web servers for fun and profit. Because if you're making an appliance to make websites go faster, you need to get a web server right to the edge and then stick your appliance in and show, you know, we reduce the load. If we're actually doing our job properly. So I think I've spent more time than anyone watching IIS right on the edge of circling the drain. Like right there. And there's certain characteristics you can see in a web server that's about to tank. And you only really need to watch four things, right? Perfmon has everything you need to know about the state of your web server. And we know what Perfmon is, right? I consider Perfmon like your own little internet inside your computer. Everything you need to know is in there, you just can't find it. Four values I watch for an ASP.NET website on a web server. CPU. It's one of the default settings, dirt simple to get at. I don't mind it hitting 100%, that's normal, but I don't like it there all the time, right? It should sawtooth a bit. That's enough for me. And the reality is, you're not gonna run a CPU on any web server, really. Most of the time, web server CPUs are smoking cigarettes and playing poker. Like, there's nothing to do, right? Serve another page, wait for the DBA, right? Serve another page, it's easy. Requests per second. So this is part of the ASP.NET application object group, because there's an ASP.NET group and an ASP.NET application group, and then it's per application you can get the request per second going to it. So that's your basic dial of how busy are we? How many pages are we serving, right? That's request per second, absolutely useful number, it's basic instrumentation. In the ASP group, there's requests queued. So these are requests that have gotten through IIS to ASP.NET, but they can't be served. And so they're being held in a queue. The correct number of requests queued is zero. Okay, so as soon as we have requests queuing, we have a problem. And typically, the only reason you have queues requests queued is that you're out of threads. Okay, now, how do you run out of threads? You have a lot of requests going on that take a long time. And odds are those requests are taking a long time because you're accessing a database, so it's clearly the DBA's fault and you can go home. There are other reasons for requests to queue. And the other one is garbage collection. When garbage collection runs, no requests can be processed. It's the rules. Now, typically, garbage collection happens in a fraction of a second, so it's not a big deal. But there are certain garbage collection incidences that happen to take longer. And that brings me to my fourth measurement of a web server, which is total bytes in the .NET heap. It's part of the .NET memory, global memory. So in a healthy web server, when it's been running for some time, and you can't do this as an easy test, it needs to run for a few hours, naturally memory generation goes over a few times, and it sort of gets to a stable set of memory. And we've got to go back to our original thinking about whole .NET. And .NET came up with this great idea, we're going to allocate memory quickly, we're going to free it slowly. And you think ASP.NET should be flawless at this, right? Because when you start up a web page, you declare a bunch of variables. Okay, we'll allocate all that memory for you. Then you do stuff with them, you render a page, and you throw everything out. And so it just marks them all as deleted, doesn't give the memory back, just marks as deleted, and a few other pages run, and every so often a GC runs and cleans all that up. And if that's all that was happening, life would be good. But you stored session in process. Bad, bad, bad. So what happens now? You do the same thing. Declare a bunch of variables. It allocates space on the heap. It works on them. And when it's finished with it, it creates that new session object, and it plunks it into memory right on top of it. Bunk. Unless it's really big, in which case it goes in the large object out buffer. But let's not even talk about that. So now here's a chunk of memory that you don't want deleted. And then the next page comes in, and it lays in another session. And then you suddenly have this fragmentation of long persisting objects all through memory. And when the garbage collector comes along, it has to shuffle them off. It has to clean all that up, and it takes longer. And if you're really running out of memory, it'll do a panic EC, and that becomes a problem. So how much memory does the .NET heap get on an average web server? So my normal web server that I deal with are the little Dell pizza boxes. 1U, 2 cores or 4 cores, 4 gigs or 8 gigs of RAM, depending on whether you're running 32-bit or 64-bit OS. And I strongly advocate 64-bit OS, and I'll tell you why. On a 32-bit OS machine with 4 gigs of RAM in it, you get about 800 megs of heap before you're out of memory. Only 800. See how 2 gigs goes to operating system, right? That's system space. Now, there is a switch you can throw called the PAE switch. It would say you only get 1 gig. But in my experience, whenever you throw that switch, what you're really telling the web server is you need to run really slow, which is not the answer to the problem. So you don't throw that switch. So there's 2 gigs gone. You've got high address memory from your video cards eating up a chunk of that. So you only get 3.6 in the first place. So now you're down to about 1.6. Then you need to run IIS, the .NET framework, your app, you know, any other number of programs, it comes down to about 800 megs. So I wrote programs that would deliberately chew up the .NET heap quickly, and you could see it run up, and around 800 megs, it would just slam down because it'd do a panic GC to free it up. So get back to our story about what does it look like for a web server about to die. The normal death spiral of IIS looks like this. You're running out of memory. You've been allocating stuff like crazy. Garbage flush is taking a long time. You're having panic GCs. Now, when the panic GC runs, shuffling all those things off, it can't process any of the requests. So the request queue grows. And you're busy, because that's why you're running out of memory. So, you know, a few hundred requests sit in the queue. The garbage collection finishes. It tries to drain the queue. It runs it out of memory again. But it doesn't finish emptying the queue. Now, the queue gets a little bit bigger. Memory does this. And you go like this. And you eventually get to a point where you're churning so hard, mom is watching. IIS is out there. She doesn't like what you're up to. And so she'll restart the worker process, which is a way of freeing up memory very quickly. But a little hard on the application. And in fact, if you go back to older versions of IIS, I've done this like IIS 5, you'll blue screen the machine doing that, which is another way of freeing up memory, but really hard on the application. So, and the fun part is, this is not manifest in any useful way to the user. Generally, no errors are generated, right? What happens? Pages go blank. You know, in our timesheet app, we've been putting in rows, one after the next. And because I've done something silly and I'm storing them all as a data table instead of a session object, halfway through doing that, they all disappear, right? Because now we've gone through one of those worker process recycles and it's just chucked all that stuff away. And now that guy's really mad at me. You follow me? So the manifestation of this is when we lose those sessions, it just keeps going around. Now, let's talk about what happens in our business next. Well, first thing is we tipped off IT that we're up to something, right? When I made that phone call. So they came to have a visit after our current version and probably gave us our own web server or at least something with a little more dedicated space, shared database server. They might even, at this point, again, we might talk about, let's shift this off to the cloud. Like, what are we doing? Right? Why is this here? Also, now we start to have our first real performance problems. How long are things running? How many threads are being eaten up of long duration? So we go and start looking, you know, that select star from table, probably not a good idea now that there's 100,000 rows in it. It was fine with 100. Now it's not so good. And the fact that you stuffed everything in this giant grid, and you know, you're generating a meg and a half of view state, you might want to make that go away. Current record I've seen was a 4 meg view state. That's a big view state. And it's taking a grid and sticking controls in every row of the grid. And they all generate view state. We've dealt with that problem before. All right. Let's talk about sort of the serious version of the app. So you may not have had a version 1 like we had. You know, may not have a viral app that was actually a planned app. You almost certainly had a version 2 in this model that you took it out for the first spin. We had these problems. We're running on real hardware. So now we start having this transition point where we have operations involved, right? And You know, today we're starting to call this DevOps, which is a great term. But believe me, we've always had DevOps. We just haven't labeled it that way. Right? Operations has a direct influence on how successful the app is. Development has a direct influence on how successful the app is. And how well those two get along directly affect how well this app is going to go. So when the IT guys show up and we all go, oh, man, you know, that's not going to help. And if you start to have this conversation now about what's the most important thing in an app, right? You know, what matters to this app? And if you have that conversation right after it crashed, the most important thing is reliability every time. In fact, I generally write down four words: performance, scalability, reliability, accuracy. Let's rank them for this app. Every app needs all four of these things. But you have this question: what's the most important thing? And the answer will be all of them, every time. And no, we really do have to rank them. So we start to have this conversation about how you weigh these things, these four measurements, right? And I put accuracy in there because most of the time accuracy is the most important thing, right? If we're dealing with a bank, I have this conversation that says, okay, so suppose I have $1,000 here and I want to put $1,000 over there. So I have a transaction, I take the $1,000 out of this account and then I put the $1,000 into that account. Now what's worse? I take the $1,000 out and it never shows up here, or I never move the $1,000. Okay, well, losing $1,000 is bad when you're a bank. So what you're telling me is accuracy is the most important. I'd rather be right, I'd rather be down than wrong. Now, not every app is like that. I worked with a company, the guys who sell stuff on TV, you know, order now, get a free set of Gensu knives. But wait, there's more. Order in the next 50 minutes, you'll get double your order. Right? Those guys, very cool business. So their whole business is based on these commercials that they run. And when they run a commercial, all of the orders they're going to get off that commercial, however much money they spent on it, happen in about a four-minute window trailing the commercial. So they have a big bullpen, all these people sitting row on row, headsets and machines, and they have a big screen at the end. And back when I was working this, it was literally one of those large projection TVs showing the time to the next ad. And so in between the ads, you know, they're out smoking cigarettes and relaxing and so forth, but there's this little bing about a minute before the next ad runs. They all get in their seats, sort of flex their hands, and they take as many orders as they can in the 4 minutes. So a few things you learn when this is going on. It's more important to get the order in than it is to get everything right, even the order, right? The main thing you want is their name, address, phone number. That's all. So we don't look anything up. We type as many things in, because there's nothing in that business that can't be fixed by free shipping, right? Truly. You ship the wrong set of knives, they call back, say, you ship the wrong set of knives. We'll keep them. We'll ship you a new set. Free shipping, right? Suddenly we had this business, accuracy wasn't that important. Scalability became the most important thing. The largest number of orders we can take in a very narrow time window dictates the success of this business. But until you work through that exercise, you don't figure it out. So most of the time you're going to find out accuracy is number one. And most of the time you're going to find out reliability is number two. And then we have the battle of performance versus scalability, and they're different, right? Performance is that single user experience, and scalability is a multi-user experience. Now, how do we describe this to someone? How important is it for someone to have this website grow really fast that we say maintain Forrester's 2-second page time? Oh, it's really important. Is it important enough that I cap the number of users that can connect to the site? Because I can dial it in so only 100 people can hit the site at any given time. Everybody else gets a 304 server too busy, and those 100 will have a great experience. They usually don't go for that. Oh, no, no, everybody's got to come in. So you would rather sacrifice performance for scalability, right? Follow me? We give it this language. Suddenly we have this ranking of accuracy, reliability, scalability, performance. Performance often comes in fourth. And once you've got that list, a lot of pressure goes down. It's okay that we sacrifice performance for scalability. This was a business discussion. Right? The company agreed, this is the order that things matter in. It's when we can't get that order that we keep going around and around in circles. Same thing with 100% uptime. Right? And this is just like going to the grocery store hungry. If you've just had a crash, 100% uptime is absolutely vital. Now, as a consultant, that's awesome for me, because I know I'm about to buy you a whole bunch of equipment. Because if we're actually going to have 100% uptime, which you perfectly well know is completely unachievable, we're going to need redundant power supplies. We're going to need redundant internet connections. We're going to need, and 200 grand later, 99% ain't looking so bad. Right? Clustering SQL Server, the licenses alone there goes 100 grand. And it goes on and on and on. Redundant load balancers. You know, it's expensive to get to that high reliability. So we have to start weighing these things off. And one of the nice things about crashes is it reminds everybody how important your app is, right? And often we can get right down to how much it costs. I've been an IT guy, right? I've lived in both lives. Devs, it's fun to be a dev because you get A's all the time. You ship a new feature, A! Ah. When you're an IT guy, if you do your job perfectly, nobody can tell. You're invisible. And I was a good IT guy. I sat in my bunker. Nobody called. I'd shut a server off. Phone rings every time. Hi. Oh, try it again. Okay, they still love me. That's the tension between the two, right? The developer's job is to ship new features, which is the thing that's most likely to cause the site to crash. So the IT guy's job is, the feature's bad, right? No IT guy ever renamed every customer John Smith, but I know some developers have done it. And the IT guy gets blamed every time. So this dynamic becomes the most important thing, figuring this out, working those priorities out, figuring out what the reasonable costs are. Now we're actually talking about a real app. So suppose we've gone through this process. We're still on one server, maybe a shared database server. We've moved this app out to a big chunk of the company. So now we go for the big run. This is hundreds of users. This is at the limit of what a given web server could actually do. Actually, 1,000 requests per second, I can build you a demo app that'll do 1,000 requests per second on a single web server, not a real app. Real apps don't go that fast. I have sites that go that fast, but if you're getting 25 requests a second out of a real app on a real web server, you're doing just fine. If you're getting 100, give yourself a gold star. There are very few apps I've found in the ASP.NET world to do 100 requests per second on one web server. So we're way over at these kinds of loads what's reasonable. Okay? These are huge numbers. They're too much. Realistically, we're not going to get there on this rig. Okay, so we're probably going to have some serious performance problems. This will probably be the first time the app hasn't broken from genuine bugs. It started to break weirdly. Right? The classic error that starts coming up now, the pure load error, is an object not found error. Because the search in between the guy entering the line and entering the next line, this worker process recycle tanked the session, and as it came back in, it went to reference something in the session object that was immediately recreated in blank, and it couldn't find it. So it really was an object not found. It just wasn't a helpful error message. Sorry. The other thing that's happened is we now have enough users, and we've been through a few of these, so we actually probably have a number of how much this is costing. Right? We're just talking about a timesheet app. But if everybody takes the whole day to fill in their timesheet times 400 people, that's a lot of money. Now, you can use that as threatening to you, or you can use it as leverage to you. This is how you justify new toys for you, right? You know how much it costs. You put together a project plan that says, if we're down for a day, you know, or if we take 8 hours to do this, it costs this much. You give me some of that, I cut that time in half, we save this much, we make it back in 3 months, right? We play ROI games. You really want to ruin the CFO's day? Get good at that, because he can't argue with you anymore. And you start making the company more money. Actually. All right. The next iteration of this, when we get into this problem, especially if the site didn't crash, it just didn't work that well, it took all day, there will be a meeting. There'll be a big table, probably a projector. There'll be a couple of IT guys on one side of the table. There'll be you and your dev manager and, you know, somebody else, and they're going to talk about why that app went that slowly. And if you're unwise, it'll be this game. It's the network. No, it's the software. No, it's the network. No, it's the software. At which point you'll decide you don't have enough information to prove that guy's wrong. You'll agree to make another meeting next week to collect more data. And then you'll forget all about it till the 15 minutes for the meeting when the Outlook thing pops up. You'll quickly thumb through some records. You'll come back and you'll do it again. And you will keep doing this meeting for the rest of your life until somebody actually gets some data together. Now, the way to make that meeting constructive is this thing I call the IQ test. It is a sort of a recognition that the devs know stuff about the app that the ops guys need to know. And there's stuff that ops knows about the infrastructure that the devs need to know. And if you can put it up on the screen, you stop yelling at each other. I'd also say this, you need to add pizza, right? Pizza is conversational lubricant. So it's good, bring in the food and kick out the manager most of the time. he hasn't anything constructive to add, except you guys really need to fix this soon. Thanks very much. Go golfing. Get out. Pay for the pizza. I'll usually start at the web config file, because if you've got an ops team that's not familiar with ASP.NET, they don't know that they should own the web config file, and they should own it. But you as a developer have set it up. So you walk through it, okay? And there's different areas in the web config file that are important, right? And this is where we talk about the fact that we have session in process. And so, you know, we're a finite to that machine. If we're going to build multiple web servers, we're going to have a problem there. The first place where you'll actually hear the network guy sob out loud is when you get to the authentication section and he finds out using form-based authentication and storing passwords in a SQL server. Then he'll cry, okay? And you will have a conversation about, hey, we paid Avanade a lot of money to put together this security report for us that says we won't store passwords in SQL Server anymore. You really need to use Active Directory. Constructive conversation, right? It's the transition of ownership. You did what was convenient for you as a developer, and now the IT guy can actually talk to you about the way the company needs to run, how we're going to secure things, and we move that stuff over. You'll also run into app settings. App settings can often have things like connection strings, behavior pieces, and so forth, opportunity to change configuration, stuff the ops guy needs to know about and how to use, and you actually, as a developer, have to use properly. So most of the time when you see an entry in the app settings, like, ah, yeah, that's a great setting. That would be really useful if we had to fail over. We can just change that string, don't have to recompile the app or anything. And that's when the dev says, yeah, if only we were actually using that setting, it'd be awesome. On the IT side, I also ask the IT guys to bring stuff to the table. One of the biggest things to start with is the network diagram. Bring us the network diagram. Let's walk through the network diagram. And the goal here is to exchange information, right? If we go through a web config file, I want the IT guy to then go through the web config file and explain every piece of it to me. And I want the dev guy to be able to explain every part of the network. Because the problem with most devs is the network, in their minds, is browser, internet, wire to web server, and maybe a database. And this is what makes the IT guy so mad at you. You reduced his job to this line. There's stuff in there. It's important. So when you bring a network diagram in, you start walking through the fact that there are users that come in through the public internet. There are users that come in through VPN connections. There are internal users. They're authenticated differently. We have IMAP servers. We have LDAP servers. We have a disaster recovery connection. You know, all that stuff affects how apps work. So once you have a picture of that, start seeing how those things work together, have a conversation about it over pizza, you can get somewhere. Another big piece for a developer to ask for is access to the production log files. Now, the answer will be no. Now, the problem is that the IT guy heard access to the production servers, and you don't want that, because then it could be your fault, right? What you want is access to the logs. Now, the truth is, if you don't know this, no ops guy worth his salt doesn't make regular backup copies of log files zipped up, stored on another server to be used as evidence against you. Okay, they're there, and that's what you want access to. So the next thing he'll say, now that you know the truth, is just ask me for them, and I'll send them to you. And then you go into Outlook, and you put a little entry in at 8 a.m. You ask every day. And after about a week, he's like, if I give you a username and password, will you stop talking to me? Now, why? Why do you want access to the log files? Couple of things. The first is they truly are the only source of the truth. Okay, that is what actually happened on the website. You have to learn to read them in a useful way, and there are tools to help you with this. Many of them are free. Go to IIS.net if you're in the Microsoft space. You know, you can do it that way. The log reader is brilliant. If you want to use web trends, I don't care. Learn to read them. Two things that I do. The first is, when we actually have a crash, looking through that and seeing what people are doing on it is very compelling. The other thing I've started doing that was incredibly valuable for folks was when we ship a new version of the site, I look at the log files every day for about 2 weeks. First off, are people using the new feature? Second off, is that feature about to kill us? Right? Because you can look at how the law, how it's being used, maybe generating errors, any number of things that be going on. You get a chance to fix it before it crashes the server. It's a good idea. And even if it isn't crashing the server, write a report. Hey, just wanted to tell you about, I've been looking over the log files for the past couple of weeks. The new feature has been used by this many different people. They're hitting it every day, obviously clearly popular. You know, great ad. We're really happy with it. I hope you're enjoying it. Good play. Use the truth. Talk more about what's going on inside that app. All right. We are now getting to big sites. We need multiple web servers. We need a load balancer. There's a number of ways to do load balancing. We need more bandwidth. Maybe our in-house network no longer makes sense. Maybe we should be moving to the cloud. You know, there's all these intervals where we can make that, have that conversation. Or should we go to a colo site? Other thing that's going to happen, from a development perspective, you can't stare at the code and make good things happen anymore. Okay? Problem with performance tuning as a whole is that highly performant code is not obvious code. It is unobvious code. It's confusing code. And so don't do it for fun. Only tune what you need to tune. So first off is, what do you need to tune? So this is when you get into using tools like profiling. I've used Redgate Ants for ages. I mean, Visual Studio has a profiler built in. There's any number of ways to do this. The challenge is you're trying to find the methods you're spending the most time on, right? And then tune those only. Anybody know what runtime intelligence is by preemptive? Runtime intelligence, have you heard of it? Okay, how many folks here are running Visual Studio 2010? Hands, please. Lots of hands. Okay, you all own runtime intelligence. It came with Studio. The problem is that preemptive makes a product called .fuscator, and it's under the .fuscator link when you install Visual Studio. And because nobody uses .fuscation, you have never opened it up to look. So what runtime intelligence actually is real-time production method profiling that doesn't impact performance. See, to use method profiling properly on a production, on an ASP.NET website, you have to build load tests that look like your production loads. So you've got to go through your log files and construct load tests that make sense. Then you've got to set up a rig that can run the site, that can do the load test again, and you strap on the profiler, which significantly impacts performance. Completely distorts the numbers anyway, but it'll help bubble up the methods you need to fix. Follow me? If you don't make a good, correct kind of load test, you can completely lie to yourself. You know, completely confuse yourself on this. So runtime intelligence lets you instrument the production load. Because let's face it, the best load test is the customers. So if you can actually instrument production effectively, it's the way to go. You own the product. Now, it's a basic version. It absolutely works. It has no timeout or anything in it. They've got a more advanced one if you want to spend a little money with them. And while I don't get paid by them in any way, I think they make great products. So I would encourage you, you own it. Take it out for a spin. You'll be amazed. The first thing you're going to find out is certain methods are going to bubble up. Now you've got to figure out how to fix it. We're back to the staring till the blood comes out of your forehead mode, right? How do I make this faster? And odds are the thing you're going to do is cache. And we could talk about all kinds of species of caching, but let's just cut to the taste of the one that matters, which is really object or data caching. So we're going to take data that's normally in the database, and we're going to store it essentially in the web server, right? Get it closer to the users, it'll take less time, which means we're making a gamble that it's going to be wrong, right? And there are consequences to being wrong. And the code itself is not that simple. So suppose we do this particular set of tests, and on our timesheet app, there's a lookup that gets run every single time the grid is rendered, which is basically going and fetching all these customer codes. And it's enough rows that it's taking a couple of seconds. And we do it every time. And we know it doesn't change that often. You know, maybe once a month or twice a month it changes. So you know, why are we fetching this from the database over and over again? Beautiful candidate for caching. So you pull out your mastering ASP.NET book, you read up a little bit on caching, you figure out you need to decay the cache library, so you've got this perfectly harmless method that just said, go fetch this list, and it would run a database query and return the list as a data table. Beautiful. Now you add caching code to it. So you say, if the cache object for the list is null, then run the query and populate the cache object and return that. And the first time you run that, it's amazing, right? You run it, takes 2 seconds to render. You run it again, happens instantly. Genius, ship it, and as the number of users rises above one, the app breaks. Because you quickly find out if you have two people trying to populate the cache at the same time, stupid things happen. So you have to put a lock in. So now you say, if the cache object is null, lock. Run the query, populate the cache object, return it. And this works, again, in test beautifully, right? I run it, it takes 2 seconds to run, I run it again, works instantly. And if I ship it, it doesn't crash anymore, but it queries far more than necessary. So suppose I have a 2-second query, but I've got people requesting twice a second. So the first guy comes in, checks to see if the thing is null, it's null, hits the lock, locks the method, starts running the query. Half a second later, second guy comes in. Is the object null? Yeah, it's still null. Hits the lock, oh, the method's locked, I'll wait. Third guy, fourth guy comes in. First guy finishes, populates the thing, out he comes. What happens to the second guy? He now gets the method. He runs the query again, because he's already passed the if. So the correct pattern is, if the cache object is null, lock. If the cache object is null, which looks stupid. right? In fact, junior programs will come along, look at that, go, why is he checking for null ties? Then fix it for you. So you got to put a comment block at the top that says, if this looks dumb to you, don't touch it. Talk to Richard. And the reason I bring this up is performant code is not obvious. It's confusing. And so don't do it for fun, right? Benchmark. Test first. Show that this is a performance problem. Make the change. Show that you fixed the performance problem. And if you haven't, revert. Don't leave that code in there. Caching's not free either. That cache object sits in the .NET heap. Now, it's at lower priority than, say, a session object. If you actually get to panic GC stage, it'll throw away all your cache objects, which makes for cool behavior if you go cache crazy, right? If you get the cache hammer and you start whacking every piece of data like it's a nail, you will run the machine out of memory. Ask me how I know, right? You can do it. It's not a good idea. Cache carefully. We started instrumenting our caches just to actually see how many times the cache object got reused. And we haven't even talked about the hard part of caching yet, because the hard part of caching is, when do we expire it? And if we're software developers, we expire it when it changes, because that's logical. The problem is, you never know when things are going to change. And you may not catch when they change. They may change in ways you can't tell. Somebody comes in, modifies the data off a different app. You have no idea that it changed. I'm a big believer in expiry by time for a couple of reasons. First is it's incredibly reliable. And even micro-caching. Caching for 60 seconds is awesomely powerful. If you've got a high-velocity cache constantly being requested all the time, and you cache for 60 seconds, you cut down a lot of load. But you also deal with the problem of when things change, people don't see it right away, right? That's what happens with caches. You add a new item, you go to check your item, you don't see it because you're still fetching from the cache. That makes you sad. But if you cache for only 60 seconds, you'll then phone me. Now, I don't answer on the first ring, right? If I wait four rings and then go, tech support, you press refresh, data's there, we're good, right? 60-second cache is pretty compelling. In fact, I think generally people are getting more comfortable with the fact that there are cache delays and things. I think Facebook has taught the world, sometimes when you post stuff, it's not immediately visible, right? But there are other ways to handle cache failures, too. It happens all the time. Everybody ever tried go shopping on Expedia, and you clicked on a flight that had a great price, and it waited a little while, and it said, guess what? We can get you that flight. Just not at that price. It's now this price. Want it? Right? What just happened? We had a cache failure. Right? Expedia doesn't hit the airlines every time you want to look at a flight. They cache them all. Because it makes 99.9% of the experience for people faster and completely happy. And 0.1 of the time, you get one of those fun messages. So if we were doing this with, say, inventory, you might sell something you don't have. Well, that's what back-ordering systems are for. So I can go to my boss and say, look, I can do this. I can create this improved experience for almost everybody. For everybody, it's going to be faster. We're even going to fail faster. We're just going to fail in new ways. If we put in a back-order system, we'll be fine. Right? Once in a while, we're going to sell something we don't have, and we'll apologize. Most of the time, they're going to get what they want, and it took them less time to get it. And that's a good outcome. It's a business discussion. Right? You can be figured out. Nothing can be free shipping. You can fix it. You're also getting into this game at version end. So this is just the endless iteration of the tech politics, that being up becomes more important than shipping new versions. And we start to have this conversation with IT of, what do I have to do to give you the confidence that we're not going to crash on the new version? Sometimes it's testing infrastructure. Sometimes it's clear reversion methods. Try the new version and be able to back out of it quickly. Deploy it on only one server of a farm of them, and we'll see what happens with those users. We're starting to see more and more techniques like this in the DevOps movement of very fast iterations. But often we're building big test infrastructures. We're doing big load tests, because if we can pass the test, that's good. You'll always have somebody out there that'll say, hey, I'm going to form a tiger team to ship these new features quickly, which is really saying, I don't want you to test it. We're just going to deploy, because every app gets tested, it just gets tested on the users. So you get the politics of how you navigate these things. Once you get into the 500-plus request era, you are in big website land. Multiple servers, there's certain techniques that we have to get into. Now your architecture mattered. If you're still in process with session, you're in trouble because the servers are really struggling with that. The GCs are constant. There's a whole bunch of things happening. You know, as soon as you go to multiple web servers, there's only three reasons to do it. Only three reasons to go to multiple web servers. The main one, the most popular one, is reliability. If that web server goes out, I have the other one to keep me going. Now, there's always the question of whatever took that web server, won't take that one out too. And that's remarkably consistent with bugs. If you have a bug and you put it on all the servers, you probably take them all. Second reason is performance. We're finally getting busy enough, enough traffic going on, that we want to share the load, and we got to do it right. And the third one is the continuous uptime through updates. I want to be able to roll out new versions of the app without ever taking the site down. I've got traffic all the time, and so we want to do this continue rolling updates. Those are the only three reasons I know of to go to multiple web servers. If you have in-process session, you've crippled all three of those things, okay? Because you aren't reliable. If that server goes down, those guys' sessions are tanked, right? They've lost. You're not performant. In-process session impairs the performance of the server. It also impairs the ability to load balance, which means you can't offload busy servers. And you can't have continuous uptime that way either, because when you have to get everybody off a server to do the update, and if they've got their session stuck there, they're never getting off there, at least not all of them. So you end up having to be out of process long-term to make that work. It's just harder. As soon as we start getting serious about caching, and we have multiple web servers, we have cache coherency problems. If you're using logical cache expiry, because you love it, you have a logical instance that destroys this cache object, because we know it's wrong, but it doesn't take out that one. So now you start building tools, playing with libraries to synchronize caches across multiple machines. And that works fine for 2-3 web servers. When you get around 6-7 of them, the noise of that conversation starts to overwhelm the network. You have to get into clusters of servers, things get a lot more complex. So cache coherency is hard, and one of the ways to resist that problem is time-based expiry. I'm not going to talk a lot about load balancing. Well, let's do a couple things. How many people here have a load balancer in their life? Okay, quite a few, wow. How many people know what load balancer that is? Not quite as many, okay. Because often, load balancer is not our problem. If we're a developer, that's IT's problem. They deal with that. And that's how you can get into situations where you've got in-process sessions, so you actually have to stick to the same server, but you haven't told the IT guys that, and so they're doing round-robin load balancing on that. And what does that look like to the user? He puts in a row as his timesheet, and then it disappears, right? So he puts in that row, he puts in another row in, and the old one comes back, and the first one's gone. So then he puts in a couple more, and then those ones disappear, and the first ones are back. And he's like, okay. And Microsoft does have a load balancing technology that comes with Windows, right? And it's free and well-priced. It has a limitation. It's not particularly fancy. It has no single point of failure. It's very much an algorithmic load balancer, so they all know what each other's loads are going to be. It can't load balance on the session cookie. It load balances by IP, which means whoever's coming from AOL like has a bad day, right? The super proxies, there's always one server that's buried by the super proxies, and that causes its own set of problems. The new content routing, what the heck is it called now? In IIS 7, there's now a tool you can install for content routing that is really intended for you to put images on one set of servers and put ASP.NET on another set of servers. By the way, if you can separate IIS from ASP.NET, have some IIS servers that just serve static files, IIS is magic like that. ASP.NET makes things work very hard, so keeping them on their own is also useful too. But that happens to have a mechanism that allows you to social balance by the session cookie. So there is a way to do that, but you need separate hardware to do it. The big players in the load balancing space, F5 Big IP, are king. And they are the guys who own the patent to the session cookie, which load balance by session cookie, which they defend vigorously. Cisco is still a big player. Citrix, their appliances have that same capability. And then you go to the second, those are expensive boxes, right? Like a Big IP box with all the gadgets, about 50 grand by two for reliability. You can go down to the Barracudas, Coyote Points, Zeus's. They're in the 5 to 10 grand range, not as many bells and whistles. But if all you want is load balancing, is not a real hard technology. The real question is, how are you actually doing the load balancing? Round robin's pretty simple. It's just you get one, then you get one, then you get one, then you get one. You can get into the fancy techniques, like a WMI, where you're actually measuring the performance of the server. Just remember that server performance is really high when things are failing. So I had a site where we were load balancing. You always send all the traffic to the fastest responding server. Well, this server, suddenly IIS wasn't running anymore, so it failed like that. And every single packet was going to it. Not a good outcome. And you got to figure out where to store your session data. So you bought into me and you said, okay, I'm not going to do in-process session anymore. You told me not to. I'm going to go out-of-process session. And there's only two kinds that come with the product. There's either you store your session in SQL Server, which is really a mean thing to do, SQL Server. Here, have a glob of data. Now give it back. Now here, have it again. Now give it back, right? You're supposed to be doing some thinking here, and you're just having to store it. We do that because we already own it, right? It's already up and running, but it's the slowest way to go. State Server comes with IIS. It's not redundant in any way. It's fast. It's faster, anyway. There are third-party state solutions. So you can go out there, take a look around for state services that just plug in, and you can dial them in and store your state that way. Big thing is keep your state small, right? Don't store objects. Keep it as small as you can possibly keep it. Funny thing that happens when you get up to large scale, you can't reproduce problems anymore. So I had a site running a very large volume, and during peak times, it would get these weird deadlocks, bad failures, right? Knock things down. And we couldn't reproduce it in the lab. We tried over and over and over again. And I finally was, we're going to have to instrument SQL Server in production to recreate this, right? This is SQL Server deadlocks. And then, you know, the deadlock problem is, okay, connection one has a resource and needs resource A and needs resource B, and connection two has resource B and needs resource A, right? Unresolvable. And SQL Server looks for these. And when it sees one, it goes, guess what? You'd lose, right? You can set your priority low. It says, kill me. You can't set your priority high. Kill him. Yeah, you can't do that, right? So it will kill one of the transactions, so it'll fail messily, and the other one will just complete having no idea what happened. And you've got to write code to clean up for this. But the devs didn't want to write the code. It's like, just stop the deadlocks. Like, okay, I can't reproduce this. So I'm going to instrument a production web server at peak time. I'm out of my mind for doing this, but I can't think of anything else we can do. So we clear off lots of disk space, because the log files on a profile like this are massive. And we fire it up, and you know somewhere between 5 and 6 is going to happen. So we're going to run it for an hour. We've got lots of disk space. We turn it on. No deadlocks. It just doesn't happen. We clear them off. We run it again for another hour. No deadlocks. And the devs are like, shoot, leave it on. Because the problem was a timing problem, right? It was at certain velocities, certain transaction rates would occur that would cause these lock collisions. I literally ended up doing was walking through the stored procedures we figured were the problem and adding wait statements to the stored procedure, and found when I added 1 second to this stored procedure, as a wait, problem went away. Totally bizarre, random, you know, try and find these things. I'd also say this. You're going to start out caching to improve performance, and after a few months, you're utterly dependent on your cache, utterly dependent on it. If you allow the user to hit the site that's not cached, it drops to its knees. And so we got into a policy where we never let the user hit anything other than a cache object. When a cache object expired, whether by time or by logic, we'd create another cache object, continuing to serve the old one, which we now know is invalid. And when we had the new one created, we'd switch them. Follow me? So the users always hit the cache. You just got to deal with the fact that you now know something's wrong and you're still saying it. Okay? But now we get back to our backorder solutions and our we really sorry that happened to you solution, you know, whatever you need to do. But you start getting utterly dependent on caching, and you just got to write this circular cache that we only ever hit from caches. You're now going to get into complex sets of hardware and software together. So dedicated accelerators, we offload HTTPS, we separate out our static resources from our dynamic resources. Maybe we go to CDNs, right, and start geolocating some of that data. And we start building more and more cache. Just do it carefully. All right, I'm just about out of time. Things to think about as you get into scaling sites. First is, do you have real data? What is reality here? Measure before you change anything. Performance work is the worst work you can do as a developer, because nobody remembers. You can spend 3 months on a performance tuning cycle, double the performance of the site, and everyone will remember that was the 3 months you didn't ship a feature, okay? Because performance is, it's like air. Nobody cares about the air in this room. Now, if I took the air out of the room, you would care, okay? As long as you have performance, you don't care about it. It's quickly forgotten, so don't do it for fun. Do it because you absolutely need to. Do it because it's become the most important feature, which means you've measured. You know what the numbers are. And then you pick the low-hanging fruit. Use the performance equation. Are we having bandwidth constraints? Are we having latency problems? Don't start changing code until you absolutely have to. And when you do, do it empirically. This is hard code to change. You're going to make it worse. And sometimes you're going to be wrong and you're going to impair performance. So roll it back when you don't get results. Again, without the measurements, you're just making stuff up. And ultimately, you're going to get to a point where everything is so tightly networked together, no individual machine is important, right? When you've really got a site that scales, you can flip servers off and nobody can tell, right? That's where we want to get to. The network becomes the computer. It's a whole. And that's becoming more and more common. You've seen the tooling this week at TechEd showed me clearly this is becoming the norm. So it's a way to think going forward that we're going to scale out systems that are utterly transparent in their individual machines. That's all I got for slides and about all I got for time. I hope you had a great tech ed. Thanks so much for coming on. And I have nowhere to go, so if you've got questions, please come and talk to me about it. I'm happy to answer anything.